Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, writer and historian Rebecca Solnit, says names have power. Terms we use, like unburnable carbon, gaslighting, the new Jim Crow, and the prison industrial complex, can point clearly to abuses of power. Distortions, like the terms chain migration, enhanced interrogation, and welfare queen, hide brutality. As she writes in her new collection of essays, Call Them By Their True Names, Rebecca Solnit says, quote, "Once we call it by name, we can start having a real conversation about our priorities and values," end quote. Rebecca Solnit is the author of more than 20 books, including the international bestseller Men Explain Things to Me. She has written extensively on topics ranging from feminism to violence to ecology. Her new book is Call Them By Their True Names, and Rebecca Solnit joins me in studio. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome to the show.
Lovely to be with you again, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. There's so many places we can start, and I thought, wow, what do we focus on? And then I got today's San Francisco Chronicle and the New York Times. And I think this says so much about where we are right now. Front page of the Chronicle, above the fold, climate change action, bold goals and protests. And a picture of activists who demonstrated in San Francisco before the Climate Action Summit, which is being led by Governor Jerry Brown. And then the New York Times, above the fold, White House set to weaken rules curbing methane. Industry hails the change, looser monitoring and repair schedules for oil and gas wells.
There's a fascinating way that California has, since the Trump election, set itself against the federal government. And I'm sure you remember Kevin DeLeon and the other sort of leader in our state legislature who issued a bilingual declaration of defiance the day after the 2016 election. And of course, it goes further back than that. With the ways this state has been a climate leader with, and now I'm forgetting so many names, that wonderful legislator who during the Bush era set the emission standards for automobiles that Obama signed into law as soon as he became president after 8 years of fighting with the Bush administration. You know, I don't want people to think, oh, everything got bad when Trump came into power.
Right.
California's been fighting the federal government, you know, for, you know, throughout this millennium around how much we're going to do about climate change. And we're not perfect, and Jerry Brown needs to, you know, ban fracking and fossil fuel extraction, but he did do a beautiful thing yesterday.
Yeah, tell us what he did yesterday.
He did two things. He signed AB 100, which radically upgrades the climate goals for California to 100% renewable carbon neutral electricity generation by 2045. And that's a pretty exciting goal. It really... And it says a bunch of things. It says, first of all, we imagine that this radical transformation is possible and we're going to lead the way as the fifth largest economy on Earth. And secondly, that California is setting its own policy and not letting the Trump administration destroy compliance with the Paris Agreement, which a lot of cities and states and regions in the U.S. have been doing in various ways. But then Brown also did another great thing, which doesn't mean that we don't hold him accountable for not stopping fossil fuel extraction, but it's still quite beautiful, which is he issued a do you remember what it's called? Like a sort of gubernatorial order that we wouldn't just do this with electricity generation, but we would attempt to be an entirely carbon neutral state by 2045, which means addressing transportation in the areas in which we use gas and, you know, fossil fuel aside from electricity generation. And that is really radical and for such a huge place. And we've seen some small countries and set goals like that. But, you know, California isn't a country, but it's bigger in population and economic clout than most countries. So mm-hmm. it's it's pretty exciting.
Fifth largest economy in the world, going back between 5 and 6.
We kind of waver. I remember when we went down to 10th or 11th. And it's weird that we have that status. It's partly about how huge Silicon Valley is and the trillion-dollar valuation of Apple recently and things. And that's not universal benefit. You know, it's not impacting the campesinos in the Central Valley and the homeless people in San Francisco in any positive way. It doesn't mean... But it does mean that we're tremendously powerful.
Let's talk about Saturday's march. It was really amazing. Over 30,000 people showed up, and it's said to be the largest climate march on the West Coast.
Yeah, and it wasn't just large. It was beautiful and diverse. There were a lot of kids there. There were the fearless grandmothers defending the mural project in the Civic Center, and a group called, I think, 1,000 Grandmothers for, Climate Action. There were a lot of indigenous groups who led the march. Mm-hmm. There were unions and labor and immigration rights. And one of the things I love about these marches is that there are chances for us to connect the dots about how human rights and climate change are not separate issues and racial justice and climate are not separate issues. And to recognize that a lot of the leadership is coming from people of color, notably indigenous people who just did so much to stop the pipeline in Canada recently and pipelines across the continent.
People from the Amazon were there. People from the South Pacific were there. I loved the contingent of the indigenous people in red trying to raise awareness about missing and murdered indigenous women.
Yeah, you can see, so many of those things go together. And there's so many ways that fossil fuel is violence, from the violence of the man camps in North Dakota and Alberta, and the way that connects to assaults on indigenous women, to the horrific health effects of fracking in the Central Valley and San Joaquin Valley here and in Ecuador and Nigeria and around the world, to climate change itself as a kind of violence, as I tried to call it out in this book.
Right. Well, and you have written more than 20 books. You've written about all of these issues, and you have done such an amazing job of really reporting on grassroots actions. What are your thoughts about how all of these different movements have really come together? I mean, I feel like in the last couple of years, there's been such a focus on bringing various movements together. And I think this march on Saturday just really showed that.
I've been an activist for a long time, and I remember how balkanized we were in the 1980s, where movements felt like I'm advocating for my subspecies, and that's not connected to your subspecies. Race is not connected to gender, is not connected to orientation, is not connected to the environment, etc. The beautiful work done by millions of people who will never get direct credit for it has been to understand how these things are related and also to act in solidarity. So, I'm not directly impacted, but I refuse to see myself and my struggle as separate from yours. Or I'm privileged to not be impacted, so I'll stand up for those who are, by racism in prison, by direct climate impacts, by immigration, etc. And there is this beautiful understanding that I think people my age have worked very hard some of us have worked very hard to develop. And you look at younger people, and it's natural to them. It's inherent to them. I looked up this amazing statistic yesterday. In 2045, the U.S. will be a white minority country.
Wow.
And it went with something else I was looking at yesterday, which is that the younger you are, the more seriously you take climate change. There was something that talked about how much more millennials care about and believe in the significance of climate change and climate action compared to, say, baby boomers, and a study that didn't address the fact that's partly because millennials are a lot less white and climate denial is part of a right-wing thing that's about older white people, what I call the destructive Docker force or destruction in Dockers. So I see this kind of beautiful elaboration of a new worldview emerging that you know, is transformative, and that is about, first of all, an ecological worldview, because the first rule of ecology is that everything is connected.
Well, and to that point, we had on three incredible women yesterday who are climate activists and so much more, doing amazing things in their communities. And we were talking about how the environmental movement, and that's huge, it encompasses so many things, but how it has really changed. And I asked our guest, Maya Bahavaj, who's with It Takes Roots. She's the coordinator at the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance. I said, do you think that the more mainstream environmental groups have done a good job of reaching out to communities of color? And it was, her response was great. She said, I think they have, they're listening to us. It's not that they need to do a good job of reaching out to us. They're starting to now listen to us. And now we have a seat at the table, which I thought was a great response.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the joys of being old, which I feel like I am now, is I've lived through that arc. And, the, you know, what is the Martin Luther King about the arc bends towards justice? I remember the rise of the environmental justice movement in the late 80s, early 90s. And my own work at the Nevada test site with my brother David, where the Western Shoshone elders showed up and said, not only do we want to stop nuclear testing, but it's happening on our land and we want our land back. And we got launched on this wonderful adventure with Carrie and Mary Dan and the Western Shoshone Defense Project that was an education for me in understanding we had to stop thinking as environmental groups had about virgin wilderness. This was always someone's homeland, and we had to respect not only the rights, but the right to take leadership on so many of these issues. I've watched that unfold for more than 25 years. And it's such a profound transformation of everything, the history of this hemisphere, what environmentalism means and how it connects to social issues, the very concepts of nature and culture. It's been really exciting and really hopeful.
And hopeful. Talk more about that, because given your experience, especially when you look at the climate movement, you know, every Monday on the show, it's called our One Planet series.
Yeah.
And we decided to focus specifically on everything from overfishing to coral reef conservation and plastic, because we knew that after the election, most of the media would focus on the tweets and what's happening in D.C., which they do, right?
Yeah.
And so we really wanted to focus on all of these issues around the climate. And it's pretty daunting when you think about where we're at right now. But as you write in your book, Call Them By Their True Names, in the section Naive Cynicism, the climate movement has grown powerful and diverse. In North America, it's shutting down coal plants and preventing new ones from being built. It's blocked fracking oil and gas leases on public land, drilling in the Arctic, pipelines, oil trains. 47 U.S. cities and towns and the state of Hawaii have committed to going 100% renewable in the near future, and now we can add California to that list. So how do you, and with given your experience, think about the possibility that we might not have fish in 2048, but then when you look at where we're at, the movement is just getting bigger and more powerful and stronger?
And it's hard and necessary to hold both of those truths at once and to see how they interact with each other. And hope for me doesn't mean that everything's going to be fine, which is what optimism is. It means rejecting both optimism, which is everything will be fine, therefore I don't have to do anything, and pessimism, which is like everything's going to hell in a handbasket and I also don't have to do anything. Hope for me means a sense of possibility and wiggle room, that the difference between the best and worst case scenarios for climate change are profound for the survival of habitats, species, the oceans, the little kids like all my nieces and nephews and great nieces and nephews and the kids around the world who are going to be alive in the year 2100, vulnerable populations. And it means that maybe we can win, and we won't win everything. And it doesn't mean the problems aren't there. It doesn't mean like, oh, we can totally fix it and we'll be like, you know, like we never raise the levels of carbon by 100 points per million over the last several decades. And that's worth fighting for, you know, and the individual victories matter as evidence that sometimes we win and we know how to do this. and that we do already have a movement. So often the left talks like nothing good is happening and we need to start from scratch, but many good things are happening. We have an amazing global movement. We just need to scale it up in power and consequences.
And like you write in your book, you never know what is happening. For example, at the march, there might be a 10-year-old girl there who becomes this fierce activist in a couple of years. I mean, you in many cases, we don't know what happens to these seeds that we're planting.
Yeah, and the divestment movement was thoroughly mocked as this kind of feeble, trivial, ineffectual thing when it was launched 6 years ago by what the climate journalist David Roberts dubbed the Doing It Wrong Brigade, who are loud and you know, and kind of raining on every parade. And Bill McKibben announced yesterday that $6 trillion have been divested and the movement is growing.
Wow.
And that he quoted Shell Oil saying this is having a real impact on their profitability and viability. And so you see these things that are often mocked because everything starts small, everything starts on the margins, everything starts as an experiment, and we don't know where it will go. You know, one of the things that has made me really hopeful comes from, and I write about this, I think at Is it in Hope in the Dark or in this book? There was a wonderful history of coal that came out at the beginning of this century. I read a few about 5 years ago, and it was just a really good history of coal until the very end where it talked about, well, here we are now with climate change. What can we do about it? And I realized, holy cow, in 2000, we did not have renewable energy solutions. Wind and solar were expensive, funky, amateur, inadequate possibilities. One of the great stories of this millennium we have never adequately appreciated because it's been so wonky and incremental is that the unsung heroes who are engineers have given us technologies that are adequate to the problem. We could go, as Mark Jacobson at Stanford with his project has shown, to 100% renewable almost everywhere on Earth. Mm. There, as the wonderful banner at the 2014 Climate March said, we have the solutions. And that's new, and that's amazing. That's why we could have this decision that will be carbon neutral by 2045.
Today we are speaking with writer and historian Rebecca Solnit, and she's out with a new collection of essays, Call Them By Their True Names. She writes, once we call it by name, we can start having a real conversation about our priorities and values. Rebecca Solnit is the author of more than 20 books and is a longtime grassroots activist. If you have any questions or comments for Rebecca about where we've been and where we are today, we'd love to hear from you. And also, if you'd like to talk about the power of language, I think about this, especially when I hear the media using enhanced interrogation. And this is media across the board, from alternative media to you name it. They use enhanced interrogation often instead of torture. And so we'll also talk with Rebecca about the importance of using the right language. Give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Another one that comes up for me when we're thinking about climate change, Rebecca, is the Keep It in the Ground movement. And a lot of environmentalists said, okay, that is just going too far. I mean, mainstream environmentalists, keep it in the ground? How can this be when people first started talking about it? So I was just looking it up, thinking that I thought a piece of legislation was recently introduced, but it was actually in 2015 when Senator Jeff Markley and Senator Bernie Sanders took that same language from activists and said, keep it in the ground. And then Representative Jared Huffman, who's out of San Rafael in California, introduced a Keep It in the Ground Act in 2016.
One of the things that has made me hopeful over the years, really starting with that work with indigenous activists, is seeing how ideas move from the shadows and the edges and the margins where they're treated as impossible, unrealistic, outrageous, and how if you don't let, you know, those definitions prevail and you kind of hold fast, those ideas become more and more realistic and possible until And the mainstream will never say, oh, we were idiots and you were right. The mainstream will just say, like, of course we always thought this. I've been watching it also with, for example, the idea of dismantling Lake Powell and Glen Canyon Dam on the Colorado River, which was, something radical environmentalists were advocating for in the 80s and 90s, and when it seemed remote and unlikely. And it now seems inevitable, partly because of the bad news of climate change. And but watching ideas kind of come in from the cold to become how people think and what people think is possible and then become what we do is, part of the kind of cultural mapping I always try and do. And it's pretty exciting when you start watching these long trajectories.
In the section in your book, Call Them By Their True Names, The Light from Standing Rock, you write, there's a lot to learn from the beautiful struggle at Standing Rock, though everyone will draw their own conclusions. You write, mine include the importance of knowing that we don't know what will happen next and have to live on principles, hunches, and lessons from history. Plenty of people made pronouncements about what was going to happen and what would never happen at Standing Rock that turned out to be wrong. No one saw this coming. And at the march on Saturday, Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Interviewed someone who said, Standing Rock just continues. It goes on and on and on.
I met a wonderful Indigenous journalist at the march who reminded me next year is the 50th anniversary of the Alcatraz occupation, which was so electrifying for me. Because like Standing Rock, that was something where if you tell it in a very linear way, like they were on Alcatraz for 18 months and then they got kicked off and some bad things happened on the island, etc., like it sounds like a defeat. But if you tell that Alcatraz articulated a pan-Indigenous identity, inspired people across the country to feel proud, to feel powerful, to feel like their struggles were possible and worth engaging in. And Standing Rock was the same kind of beacon. I was in Utah last month and I met some young climate activists who were telling me about meeting young Indigenous activists saying, because of Standing Rock, we felt powerful, we felt hopeful, we felt like we could do this. And that's about the incalculable and how important it is to always recognize that consequences will be in part incalculable. They won't be immediate, direct. Because people, as I said in Hope in the Dark years ago, often want instant results guaranteed or your money back. Like, we had an action on Tuesday and they fell to their knees and admitted we were right on Wednesday. And it doesn't necessarily work that way. And it doesn't mean you lose when it doesn't work that way. Mm. And that's been so much of trying to just get people to have more subtle, nuanced, patient, long-term frameworks for understanding how our power works, how change works, how history unfolds.
Right. And also talking about language, it's so important to be very honest with language. Today we are speaking with Rebecca Solnit about her new collection of essays, Call Them By Their True Names. And one other section, The Light from Standing Rock, she says, consequences are often indirect. The movement at Standing Rock may yet stop a pipeline. Whether it does or not, it has brought together perhaps the greatest single gathering of Native North Americans from Canada as well as the U.S. And that has been a profound and moving watershed for the growth of transnational network of solidarity, the affirmation of cultural identities and political rights. It's demonstrated yet again that the environmental movement and human rights campaigns are often inseparable, reminding us that worldwide, Indigenous people are at the forefront of the climate movement and that many non-Native people respect and look for leadership from these cultures. Many things we cannot foresee may come of this gathering and its vision, tactics, and power. Rebecca Solnit is author of the collection of essays, Call Them By Their True Names. She is the author of more than 20 books, including the international bestseller, Men Explain Things to Me. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by author and historian Rebecca Solnit. We're talking with her about her new collection of essays, Call Them By Their True Names. Rebecca is the author of more than 20 books, including the international bestseller, Men Explain Things to Me. Well, let's get to the main argument of your book, and it focuses on the importance of calling things by their names. And I mentioned a couple terms we use like gaslighting, the new Jim Crow, the prison industrial complex. point clearly to abuses of power. And I was actually watching Meet the Press this weekend, and they were talking about Colin Kaepernick and Nike, which we won't even go there. But Chuck Todd said Colin Kaepernick took a knee to raise awareness about racial injustice. And I almost fell off the couch. Chuck Todd said he's doing this for racial injustice. He didn't call it controversial. It's interesting how language, it takes a while, but it does, as you say, infuse itself into the mainstream.
What's amazing about that is something that I recognize in myself, too, is how much we just expect euphemism, platitudes, evasions, misdirections from mainstream political speech, the kind of parallel universe they create through rhetoric, and how shocking it is when kind of the, you know, you see the little man behind the curtain, to use a Wizard of Oz, old Wizard of Oz thing, when somebody calls something by its true name. But part of why I think it's important is once you call something by its true name, like once we call torture torture, you can't stand in the Senate and defend torture, because torture is torture, and not only is it illegal, it's morally reprehensible. And so the process of, you know, these circumlocutions and denials and pretenses, you know, calling, you know, like what if we had a counter narrative around Bill Clinton's welfare reform and Putin's doing so-called pension reform right now? That's the same thing. It's called cutting people off from their benefits. And if we had called it mass impoverishment, you know, or child hunger program, child hunger enhancement,
exactly.
Or, you know, and so it's always so interesting seeing that every battle is in part a storytelling battle. What's the story? Who gets to determine what the story is? And so much of the work we need to do of resistance is resisting the narrative, whether it's a narrative that we had a free and fair election in 2016, or the narrative that, you know, that everything's fine and everybody just needs to turn out and vote, rather than that there are deep fundamental problems in how this country functions, that, you know, and then there's the problems of kind of evasion. I argue somewhere in this book, I think it's in this book. It's funny, I write, you know, it's a collection of essays. I write so much stuff. But that climate change should have been a giant headline above the fold of the front page of every newspaper every day for the last 30 years. And, you know, and treating it as kind of one little problem among others, rather than the very nature of our planet and the stable conditions in which human civilizations evolved are now falling apart.
That is this book, because you do point out future generations are going to curse most of us for distracting ourselves with trivialities as the planet burned.
Yeah, and you know, and you get in, and it's something I'm always trying to say on social media and in articles, which is, in 100 years, in 1,000 years, in 10,000 years, what will matter more than anything is what we did about climate and what we're doing about climate, and what we're doing to the climate. And there used to be an Earth First bumper sticker: "There are no jobs on a dead planet." And that's still true, you know, and that all these other factors, you know, there isn't anything that isn't impacted by it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the bottom line. And it's like, you know, it's like adjusting your state of mind or your wardrobe while your body is rotting, you know, or dying. It's like treat the illness.
Since you brought up media, let's talk about the section in your book called Break the Story. And wow, you are so lucky. I had no idea that you studied under the amazing Ben Bagdikian, who died in March 2016. Really amazing journalist.
And I didn't study enough. I only had one class with him. I regret I didn't have more. But just to have his influence around, he was both kind of a monumental figure of principle. He was an early kind of issuer of warnings about the consolidation of media and what that meant in the 1980s, and when media was far less consolidated than it is now. And of course, he was the principal figure in the Pentagon Papers, who you could see last year in that movie, The Post. I was very excited to see the actor playing him, and it reminded me, like, wow, my teacher was really important. He was also a deeply kind man. And one of the things he told me was that you can't be objective, but you can be fair.
Yep.
And he was, you know, because there was this sense in those days that the news was objective, which was something postmodernism and other things have taken on. There is no neutral position. There is no, you know, and it's better to be honest about your biases than to pretend that they don't, you know, don't exist. Or maybe even bias isn't the word, the perspective from which you see the world. And, you know, and he was an amazing figure.
What do you say to young journalists? Because I'm often struck when young journalists come in, they always ask about objectivity. And I'm just wondering what's being taught right now about this, because that's usually the first question they ask. And in your book, as you just said, objective is a fiction that there's some neutral ground, some political no man's land you can hang out in, and that you and the mainstream media, even what you deem worthy to report and whom you quote is a political decision.
Yeah, and I think objectivity has been uniquely treated as a property of straight white Christian men, that the points of view that come from people who aren't white, who aren't cisgender, who aren't male, are often treated as subjective. A woman says he assaulted me, and she's supposed to be subjective, and he says I didn't assault her, and everybody's like, oh, I just assume he has the facts. And it's one of the huge transformations of Me Too, is to shift who has credibility, and that's been a huge part of my work in my feminist writing, is addressing who gets to tell the story, who's treated as a person, who's in charge of truth and facts and what really happened, who gets discredited and how and why. And so I think what's been treated as objectivity is a tremendously political thing where, you know, and you see it around white people suggesting that black people's views on racial injustice are somehow biased or unreal, you know, that black experience can be discounted as subjective, white experience is objective, when it's often people who, like, haven't even tried to see what's happening. Mm-hmm. So I think it's often a very dangerous and concept used to bludgeon voices into silence or to discredit them. And, you know, and back to Bagdikian, you can't be objective, but you can be fair. You report on what happened at the march, and you can report on, you know, three kids who did something they weren't supposed to, or 100 grandmothers who did something amazing on, you know, and we all choose the facts. We choose to represent something, and that's accords with our values and priorities. And you see, God, I could launch into many long anecdotes about the New York Times, which cherry picks facts in very bizarre ways over and over. But, you know, and being fair, I think, is about recognizing the limits of your view, your responsibility to try and represent or at least recognize other views. And, you know, and so I think that journalists need better standards in objectivity.
I also appreciate what you write about, quote, advocacy journalism, which is often used as an incriminating term, but almost any good expose is advocacy. You write, if you're exposing a president's lies as Ben Bagdikian and Daniel Ellsberg did, you probably think presidents shouldn't lie. If you're exposing a corporation's contamination of the water table by fracking, you're probably not in favor of poisoning, or at least you're in favor of people knowing.
Exactly. You know, that there are assumptions embedded in every story, starting with this story is worth telling, this story matters, and this is what the story is. And to pretend otherwise is a huge disservice. And there are, you know, and there are values there. And it's all kind of awful often seeing the mainstream media assume that they are neutral rather than that they think unions are unreasonable and demanding Corporate leaders are reliable sources of information. Fossil fuel is an inevitability that we must have and continue to use. Like all those mainstream people going on about, has Me Too gone too far last year? Because, which was a lot of mainstream people editorializing, and they were advocating on the behalf of powerful men who had assaulted and abused and silenced women. And it's like, what subjectivity makes them pay more attention to the rights of abusers than abused people? What makes them think the story should be told by, the men who abuse and not the women who are abused? How does that uphold a status quo? And how are we trying to change it? And what happens when you start to hear voices that haven't been heard before? And interesting things happen. Roger Ailes gets pushed out of Fox News. Moonves gets pushed out of CBS this week. And, when you call things by their true names, including calling these men rapists, harassers, creeps, misogynists, and felons, interesting things happen and are happening now.
We're joined today by writer and historian Rebecca Solnit. We're talking about her new collection of essays, Call Them By Their True Names. She writes, "Once we call it by name, we can start having a real conversation about our priorities and values." And if you have any questions or comments for Rebecca about climate change, about Me Too, about where we've been, where we are, where we're going, you can give us a call. Also, the importance of really calling something by its true name, torture instead of enhanced interrogation, is one really great example. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Since you brought up Me Too, and you've written so extensively about it, I'm glad you brought up Les Moonves, because, wow, this is a guy who made about $69 million a year. One of the top highest paid CEOs in the world. According to Vox, he makes 595 times more than the average person at CBS. And he is the guy who, right before the election, told an investor group, basically, "Go, Donald, go. It's really bad for the country, but it's really good for us." Because, of course, Trump made so many media outlets so much money. CNN, CBS, he's still making them a lot of money. Word on the street, according to reports, is he could get $120 million severance. I mean, this is huge that he stepped down, because when the piece first came out in The New Yorker, he denied it. CBS was backing him, but more women are now stepping forward, and he stepped down.
Thank you, Ronan Farrow, who did the reporting. And the most useful Oedipus complex on earth. What was I going to say? I think there's something else to say about when we change the story. There's a huge question. The question Tonto asked the Lone Ranger, what do you mean we? Women have not been able to tell these stories. The victims have not been able to tell these stories. And the fact that some of the most visible people in the world, the Woody Allen, Harvey Weinstein, Les Moonves, all these huge figures in media and entertainment, Louis C.K., did horrific things to women and counted on their ability to override them, counted on their ability to silence them, counted on their ability to be voiceless, or if they spoke up, to be punished, discredited, not believed, is about us not only what is the story, but who tells the story. And Me Too is about, it's as though all these voices, all these stories were locked up behind a dam, and the dam broke, and this torrent scoured out the landscape. And to think about what monstrous machineries were set in place so these hyper-visible figures could be lauded, rewarded, treated with respect when they're committing felonies that they should be in prison for is astounding. And, it talks about how corrupt our system is, how many silences are built into it, how many people aren't given a voice to tell their stories. And, the fact that it's changing now is exciting. I've been waiting for this my whole life, and I've been impacted by violence against women really since birth. since violence against women and girls and children, you know, it's something I've been passionate about, and that made me a feminist when I was 19 or 20 dealing with street harassment. I've been writing about since 1985, and I kept waiting for the world to take it seriously. And it, this incredible feminist insurrection that began in late 2012 really stepped up 11 months ago. And it is so exciting and so needed, and it so changes the story by calling things by their true names, by calling rapists rapists and sexual harassers, by calling out abuse, by naming names, by making men appear as they truly are rather than having these facades of respectability. And a really important point is not just that Les Moonves was excited to profit off Trump and stuff, but that so many of the men who shaped the narrative of our election by giving Trump a free ride and demonizing Clinton in a lot of weird ways were men who turned out to be serial sexual abusers, the Matt Lauers and Charlie Roses and et cetera, were misogynist creeps, which was demonstrated by their actions against specific women, but also by their narratives. And this was tolerated. We had a, and it's more evidence of how deeply biased and corrupted and vicious the mainstream is, the mainstream that claims objectivity, and that objectivity that's always included massive misogyny, massive racism, massive homophobia.
I mean, there are so many layers. I think that we should still talk about how the media covered the presidential election. Steve Almond, a writer from the East Coast, I love how he says, if the media had treated Trump like Jeb Bush or any of the others, he would have been a fringe from the beginning, and he would have dropped out in the beginning. But they didn't treat him like the others. They put him on a pedestal.
One, they didn't treat the Russian intervention seriously enough. And there's stuff like when Harry Reid issued a letter to James Comey and President Obama saying, you're sitting on explosive information the public has the right to know. Why the hell didn't wasn't that front page news around the country? What was the explosive information? Did we have the right to know? Why were they withholding it? What did it tell us about the, you know, and so much of that was there, but they really sort of trivialized that, put it on the back pages, reported in fragments. And the fact that Trump was massively corrupt, massively financially incompetent, charged. And you can see these crazy things. The Obama administration on October 9, 2016, did release a mild statement about Russian intervention, which was overtaken by the Access Hollywood videotape. And then there's, of course, the fact that WikiLeaks seems to be a kind of arm of the Putin administration. WikiLeaks immediately put out all the hacked emails, and the media accepted these distractions and ran with the distractions. They didn't go hard enough, even like they made lots of entertainment out of the Access Hollywood scandal, but they didn't say, wow, this guy might be a rapist. Are we going to elect a rapist? Let's listen to the woman. And, you know, and the media is as responsible as anything, you know, along with Republican voter suppression of people of color and poor people and students, you know, and et cetera, for why Donald Trump is president.
The other thing you write in your book, and I so appreciate this, I think it deserves so much attention, how really voter suppression has prevented millions of people from voting. And even in the year 2000, when, as you write, Ari Berman, the incredible journalist who exposes so much of this, wrote about how I think it was 30,000 mostly black people were pushed off the rolls in Florida, right? Going to vote.
Yeah.
Nope, you're not on the roll. Okay, that experience is so humiliating. I would love Ari to, or someone to interview these people to say, are you voting? Or was that?
I think he has with Wisconsin, where 20,000 people, I think, were prevented directly from voting, about 200,000 people, mostly poor people and people of color overall. And Trump won that state by a tiny margin, far, far smaller than the number of voters who were prevented from voting. So, yeah, and something that I felt really connects me too in voter suppression is they're both stories about people who lost their voices, their ability to shape their own lives and the world around them, about the suppression of of populations, women around sexual abuse, poor people, students, people of color, around their right to vote, you know, that in a way, the political realities of this country is a story we tell together. We want these people in power. We have these priorities. We want this war. We don't want this war. We want coal mining. We don't want coal mining. Voting is one of the ways that you weigh in on it. And if you prevent, you know, a rough calculation I came up with talking to some experts, and including also all the prisoners and ex-prisoners who are disenfranchised, which is another 6 million, possibly 20 million people have been prevented from voting. And that means, and often when I talked about that, since you always get attacked for sounding pro-Hillary Clinton, people would say like, oh, that's you being pro-Hillary. And I was like, no, actually it isn't. If those 20 million people were, if we were in a country where everybody was not just given access to voting, but was encouraged to vote, the Republican Party would be dead on a national level. They are a minority party who can only succeed as a party of white grievance by massive voter suppression, and that has been an active campaign of theirs and a very successful one of theirs for decades. It's getting more and more extreme. But the Democratic Party, if it had to be accountable to this population, would be a far more radical party. It might not be running. In fact, it probably wouldn't be running people like Hillary Clinton. It would be running, you know, different candidates, and we would have different political races. We would have different, and if the Republican Party is defunct, which I think it will be, when that 50% of people under 18 who are not white become the voting majority in a before long, you know, we're going to be in a radically different country, and they're attempting to suppress those populations and democracy and what I see as a really beautiful future that will be ushered in if we just let these populations have their rights and full participation.
I mean, the main point you're making, Rebecca, is we would be living in a completely different country.
This country has been made by the suppression of voices. Just, you know, patriarchy is one version, racism is another. So many people have been taken out of the game one way or another. And they're the best of us in so many ways, and with important stories to tell. When it comes to climate change, it's people of color who are most ardently committed, and the young. And like, so much of the work we need to do now is to just democratize the full participation in domestic life, the workplace, education, electoral politics, etc. And in a sense, that will take care of everything.
Rebecca Solnit is the author of more than 20 books, including her latest collection of essays, Call Them By Their True Names. Rebecca, thank you for your work, and thank you for coming in.
My pleasure. I love KLW. I have so much enthusiasm for what you all have been doing since forever. I've been listening my whole adult life, and I'm just grateful to be here.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.